Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. Of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we hope very, very soon we're going to have John Stormer on the line with us. But I'm just going to give you just a little music, and I'm going to ask our producer to come in here. Hopefully we're going to be able to get him tracked down here in just a moment. So we'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, anyway, Dr. Stan here, and the guest tonight, John Stormer, is really one of my favorite people. I hadn't met John until maybe 6 or 8 years ago, but I'd always felt I'd known him, because back in 1964, he wrote a wonderful book called None Dare Call It Treason. And that book, of course, had a profound impact on the election in 1964, that along with Phyllis Schlafly's book, really mobilized the conservative movement and led to the nomination of Barry Goldwater. Now, if every American could have read None Dare Call It Treason, and about 7 million copies went out at that time, why, it might very well have turned America around. An awful lot of people did read the book and came to understand that we've not only faced a communist movement in the world, but the communist movement was really being backed and financed by powerful and wealthy capitalists here in the United States. And that's really what's so incredible about this whole story, is that people don't understand that there were communists working at the highest levels of our government. There were communists who wanted China to go communist and wanted Eastern Europe to go communist and wanted to centralize all power with Washington, D.C., here in this country and create a fascist society and wanted a world government, but they were never the people who were really making the decisions. Those decisions were made by people from the Council on Foreign Relations and other people of great wealth and great power who had a different dream, who had a different vision. And, of course, when John Stormer wrote his book, he didn't understand the spiritual implications of what was going on. But, of course, a couple of years later, he became a Christian. He actually became a Christian minister, and he was a minister probably for 30 or more years. Now John's retired, as I am, and he still spends full-time trying to educate people about the spiritual battle going on behind the scenes. He spends one day a week in Missouri at the state capitol, talking to legislatures and leading prayer sessions for them. He has been one of the giants of the conservative movement for many years, a very humble man, a very intelligent man. He's as big as I am, and I always enjoy going to meetings now. Very often we will share rooms. We got to know him very, very well personally. But John Stormer does a wonderful, wonderful job. And, of course, he's written a number of other books. One of them is None Dare Call It Education, which we carry. Another is None Dare Call It Treason, 25 years later. The most recent book, Betrayed by the Bench, goes into the background of the decisions by the Supreme Court that step by step have begun to destroy the religious foundations of this country. And it didn't happen by accident. The people working on our Supreme Court knew exactly what they were doing. And we'll be back in just a moment, hopefully, with John Stormer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, hopefully very soon, is going to be John Stormer. We're talking about John's latest book, Betrayed by the Bench, which is the single best book that's been written on the Supreme Court. And believe me, I have a lot of books written by very knowledgeable people, and some of them are very close friends of mine. But John has really crystallized what the whole issue is. You see, America was founded by Christians on biblical principles. And the entire concept of virtue, which was installed in our Constitution, this idea that men could be free and the power of the central government could be limited, the virtue was instilled in our Constitution, had its origin in those words that were outlined in the Declaration of Independence. In fact, the Declaration of Independence is really the Articles of Confederation, the contract upon which America was founded. And it's that concept laid out in the both in the first and second paragraphs. In the first paragraph of the Declaration, it talks about the fact that man's freedom is instilled in him by nature's God and nature's law. And in the second paragraph comes that great and wonderful statement: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed." You have government to protect our God-given rights. That's what it was all about. So how did we get to where we are today? Well, John's on the line. John, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a privilege.
Well, I've just been sort of introduced you. I said all sorts of good things about you before you came on. Anyway, this is John Stormer, who's written Betrayed by the Bench. And tell us a little bit about the book. Why is it different than the other books? Because I know it's different, and I've just told them I think it's the best book we have. But why is it important that people understand what the Supreme Court has done?
Well, it's important because they have basically betrayed the vision and the intent of the Founding Fathers. You just quoted the first two paragraphs in the Declaration of Independence, which are really the foundation of our whole society and of our liberty and our freedom. And really, the message of the book summed up very succinctly would be that you cannot properly understand or apply the Constitution apart from the Declaration of Independence and those truths. And
hold that thought for just a moment. We're going to bring our other stations back on right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John Stormer is with us, and he's simply saying that you cannot understand our form of government unless, of course, you understand the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, the first paragraph, which refers to nature's God and nature's law, and the second paragraph, which lays out the fact that our rights, our life, liberty, and property come from our Creator, that all men were created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that governments were instituted among men to preserve our God-given rights. So pick up the story there, John.
Well, that's the concept that makes the United States, America, different than any other nation in history. The fact that our rights come not from a king, not from, as the English writes, the Magna Carta was something that the king agreed to. It's not even from a constitution or the Bill of Rights. They were just written to protect our rights. They don't give us any. And that's what sets America apart from any other nation in history. And we cannot properly understand or apply the Constitution apart from that. And that's the thing that the Supreme Court and our legal system and our education system during the last 75 years has just turned totally away from. And the fact that the Supreme Court could in the last 40 years or so find rights supposedly in the Constitution to abort babies, to give mothers the permission to kill their babies, their unborn babies. The court in recent years has found a constitutional right, supposedly, in the Constitution written to make secure God-given rights. They've found rights to practice sodomy, which God labels as an abomination and sin. And further, we can look back. How could a constitution written to make God-given rights secure make it unconstitutional to publicly acknowledge God or have kids pray in school or post the Ten Commandments or the other things that the court has done in recent years?
But, of course, isn't this all a very intentional effort to undermine the Judeo-Christian foundation of this country, the religious concepts that, upon which our freedom is based, and by so doing, to really destroy the foundation of our freedom?
Exactly. The change that's come about, and really the Supreme Court didn't play a big part in this. The legal education system and some socialists and atheists who hated God laid the foundation back in the 1800s as they picked up the teachings of Hegel, who said everything's under a continual state of change, and Darwin, who said picked up Hegel's view kind of and applied it to biology and biological species and said they're continually evolving, and people at Harvard, Christopher Columbus Rangdell, the dean of the Harvard Law School in 1873, and some of his disciples picked that up and said that law too must continue to evolve. And their goal for that was, being disciples of Hegel and Darwin and those other anti-God forces, their real goal was they hated the whole legal foundation on which America's legal foundation grew, the common law that started to develop back maybe in the 1500s in England and was codified, you might say, through Blackstone. And Blackstone made it very, very plain that our whole legal system and the common law derived directly from the laws of nature and nature's God. That's where that phrase in the first paragraph of the Declaration comes.
I think it's so important for our listeners to know that Blackstone was basically the man who wrote the commentaries on the laws of England, and every lawyer in England, and for 100 years after our Constitution was established, every lawyer in America looked to Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England as the very foundation of American law. And of course, the whole concept of the laws of England were based upon the Bible, and Blackstone made that very clear as well, didn't he?
That's right, and in fact, Blackstone made it very, very plain in his commentaries, and it was adopted into our law, that any law, if a king, if a legislature, if a judge should make any law or any ruling that in any way conflicted with the Word of God, it was null and void. And that was the basis on our law. Lawyers were taught that. In fact, back at the time of the War for Independence and the writing of the Declaration of Independence, most lawyers were either seminary trained or they read law as an apprentice under a trained lawyer. Charles Gaddison Finney, for example, the man who became the greatest evangelist of the first half of the 19th century, Finney started out to be a lawyer. He was not a Christian, he was not a Bible believer, but as he studied law, he saw the continual references in judicial decisions to laws, to the Word of God. And he decided that if he was going to be a good lawyer, he'd better find out what the Bible had to say. And he started to study it, ended up getting saved, became a Christian, and went on to be an evangelist rather than being a lawyer.
And I think it's so vitally important that people understand that, up until about 50 to 60 years ago, everybody in the whole world knew America was a Christian nation. And then by a concerted effort with the cooperation of the media and certainly the motion picture, more recently the motion picture and television industry, but with certainly the financing of the great tax-exempt foundations and many of our corporations that hate America and hate individual freedom, why they've gradually eroded this whole concept that America was a Christian nation to the point where now they've even taken many of our major stores have instructed their clerks not to say Merry Christmas, you know, during this Christmas season. They're to say Happy Holidays or Merry Holidays, or in fact, even we're going to call the Christmas tree in Washington, D.C. It was to be referred to only as a holiday tree, not as a Christmas tree. And Dennett Hassert, who is the Speaker of the House, was furious at this, said, "This is a Christmas tree, it's not a holiday tree," and I'm sure he doesn't understand what's really going on, but at least he had the intelligence to speak out and say, "This is wrong."
People are starting to see some of the symptoms, and they get upset about the symptoms, which the whole Supreme Court actions on abortion and denying prayer and Bible reading and finding constitutional rights to practice sodomy. Those are just symptoms. And that's the difference between my book and the other good books, Men in Black, Phyllis Schlafly's Supremacists. There's a number of other good books that deal with the symptoms, deal with the problems, but they don't go back to look at the foundations. And my contention is in Betrayal on the Bench, Betrayal by the Bench, that you cannot really make any progress is getting us back to the foundations until we understand the foundations. Yeah. And the others proposed some constitutional amendments. And for 40 years, people that object to Roe v. Wade, object to the banning of prayer in school, have proposed constitutional amendments to remedy these problems the courts have. We aren't any further along. In fact, we're worse off now than we were when we started all these protests. And I'm not against the people who've raised the cry, but they need to get back to the foundations and start, rather than just decrying that abortion takes life and so forth, the other good things that the pro-life people do. But they need to get back to the foundation and start asking the question. And I've seen this now as I've been doing it for a few years. People's eyes pop open when you say, how could the court find in a constitution written to make God-given rights secure, how can they find there a constitutional right to abort babies or practice sodomy or whatever? And you got to start with the Declaration of Independence.
And that's really why it's so important people understand that this was basically the very framework upon which our Constitution, which our freedom rests. And, of course, what we have certainly is a group of Supreme Court justices who had an agenda. Now, if you want to change America, you can do it. You can amend the Constitution. These people did this.
But you're not going to be able to amend the Constitution with the attitudes that in the United States Senate and across the country. We're going to have to develop an understanding of where we came from. And really, the schools of America have a very deep responsibility. I haven't been able to find a public school history or government textbook published in the last 75 years that explains to young people the thing that makes America different. That our rights come not from a king, not from a government, not from a constitution, but from God.
Well, that's, of course, because the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation started rewriting our textbooks 75 years ago.
That's right.
To take any mention of God or these basic principles of American government out of the textbooks so that our students would never know the truth about our heritage of freedom. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with John Stormer, and this is so seminal to an understanding of what's happening today. The enemy is not over in Iraq. The enemy is not hiding in a cave. In Pakistan, the enemy is right here. And the war in Iraq is simply a diversion from the loss of our freedom here at home. Well, our guest this evening is John Stormer, and John is simply talking about how important it is for people to understand the foundation of our freedom. How are we going to get people to understand that America was founded by Christians on biblical principles, and it was from those concepts, that and the limitations upon the power of government, that our freedom came? John?
Yes.
How are we going to get people to understand?
Well, we're going to have to get individually educate ourselves, and that's one of the reasons why I've written Betrayed by the Bench. And then I think that, well, in fact, the book's been out now about 6 weeks or so, and people who got the book 6-7 weeks ago, I'm starting to get calls from all over the country from people who got the book, read it, and say, I want to get 5 of them, I want to get 10 of them, I want to get 20 of them, and we need to get them to our preachers, because as I've presented this message in churches, I've actually, and literally, every time I'm in a church, I ask if I can teach Sunday school as well as preaching in the service, and I teach this message, and I've had people literally, 60-year-old, I remember down in the Missouri boot heel, down in the country, about 2 years ago, I presented the message on that we've been talking about. And at the close of Sunday school, 2 60-year-old men came up, and one of them had tears in his eyes, and he said, why have I never heard this before? He said, I went through school, I'm a high school graduate, and he's been in a good church. But, and the sad thing is that I just recently was at a Christian school convention up in Maryland. There were schools from 6 different states there. And I presented this message, and history teachers who are graduates of good Bible schools, Bible training institutions, they all agreed, we've never heard this before. And they further added then, I mentioned you can't find the message in public school history or government textbooks in the last 75 years. The good Christian school history and government textbooks, they're good in many ways, but they never, never teach young people the thing that makes us different is that truth in the Declaration of Independence, that our rights come, again, not from a king, not from government, but from God.
And, of course, there's been such an organized, orchestrated effort to remove that concept from the hearts and minds of our people. And so that a lot of people today, when the holiday season comes, they say, Happy Holiday, when their minds have been conditioned to take the Christ out of Christmas. And certainly as we watch television, we see the programs undermining the Bible, and so many of the programs that you'll see at Christmas time did not tell the Christmas story. They question the Christmas story, and they bring in all sorts of commentators on the Christmas story, but they never get back to what it was really all about. I mean,
that's right.
Christmas has to do with the birth of our Savior. And a discussion of America has to do with the biblical concepts that were laid out in the Declaration of Independence, certainly were known to every one of our people in America up until about 75 years ago. Everybody in America, everybody in the world knew America was a Christian nation until 75 years ago. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is John Stormer, and we're talking about his book, Betrayed by the Bench, and it's the story, really, of what's happened, how a group of lawyers, really starting back in the 1800s, working there at Harvard Law School, and you have to understand that Harvard was originally created, actually, to train ministers. It was originated in 1637. That's when Harvard was first commissioned, and it wasn't very long before it had been taken over by people who had a different agenda, and has been used for that agenda ever since then, but they took over the law school, and there in the law school, then they began to train the lawyers, and not to tell them the truth about America, but to try to get them to believe that it was the purpose of law to change our structure of government. So it wasn't simply this one Christopher Columbus fellow. What was his name?
Christopher Columbus Langdale.
Right. There were a series, really, of people at Harvard who were instrumental in bringing about the changes, weren't there?
And they trained and had influence over a man named Roscoe Pound, who became the dean of Harvard Law School in 1916 and was there for about 20 years and influenced presidents and Supreme Court justices. And he wrote a number of books. And in one of them, he said it very, very clearly in his book, Law and Morals, which if you read the book, it's a contradiction. But on page 13 of that book, he said, the state has replaced Jehovah handing down the law from the mountain. And we've come to that place where we've eliminated God from the legislature has become, or judicial decisions have become, the law of the land and the ultimate authority.
And that was never meant to be. The judges were to interpret the Constitution, not to modify it according to the whims of their desires.
And again, the sad thing is, Roscoe Pound's books were widely distributed. He said what he was going to do. And the sad thing was that back in, as I like to study church history, during much of the 20th century, the church came to a place, Bible-believing churches, came to such a place that their emphasis was on our citizenship is in heaven, and praise God it is, ultimately. But they ignored what was going on, and they ignored their responsibility of teaching their people, and as a result, these things went on, and nobody was aware of it until finally, when prayer was banned by the Supreme Court, or abortion, some of these other things, and everybody says, how did this happen? Well, anybody that had really been informed and kept an eye, you know, the scripture that has been a real motivation, a foundation for much of my ministry for a number of years, 1 Chronicles 12:32 says, and of the children of Issachar, they were one of the 12 tribes, were a man that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, and the heads of them were 200, and all their brethren were at their commandment. And I believe that God is saying there that God's people should, first of all, know what's going on in society and evaluate it from a biblical standpoint and know what the nation ought to be doing, and then they can provide the leadership. And that, of course, is what happened and why we're independent as a nation today, that we've lost all sense of that.
Well, certainly today there's so many people who rely upon Romans 13 that we're simply to be submissive to the state. But how do you counter that argument? After all, Paul said we should just submit to the state, that God put those people over us, and we're not to object no matter how evil they are.
Well, I think that what we have to do is look at, first of all, the entire Bible. And Paul was one who, while he said submit, he was also the one in Acts 16 that when they put him in jail wrongly at Philippi, and they finally decided maybe they were wrong and they turned him loose or tried to turn him loose, and he said, in just a minute, he said, those magistrates got to come down here and be instructed as to what their correct position is and what the real rights we have as Roman citizens. So I think that while we are to submit, we are also responsible for making our legislators, our elected representatives, accountable to the foundational document.
I agree that totally. And of course, the thing is, Paul was writing about an authoritarian Roman structure. We're talking about an American republic based upon God's law. And when the ministers tell us we're not to be involved, then they're saying, well, God is to be involved either. America was certainly the pinnacle of man's hope down through the ages for a land where men could be free. And I really hold the church in many ways responsible for the progressive loss of our freedom as America turns from God to atheism and now to paganism. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is John Stormer, and we're talking about his book, Betrayed by the Pinch, which I believe is a very important book that everyone should read and reread two or three times, because there's certain truths there that, of course, I read a lot of books, but this book, you know, I would read a paragraph and I'd go back and reread that paragraph because, of course, there is so much wisdom in it. And you've been working at this for a long time, haven't you, John?
Yes, I thought I was a liberal back in the 50s, and then I heard a fellow named Barry Goldwater, and that kind of shook me that most of what I'd been taught about government and the purpose of it was incorrect. And then I started to look into the inroads communism made, and it just developed and developed. And then in 1965, I came to see that however desirable a new man in the White House might have been, and all the other things that I was concerned about, that there was a foundation there, and it was God. And I had to face the fact that while I had grown up in the church and gone to church all my life and tried to be a good guy, I didn't really understand God's way of salvation. And as I came to see in the Bible that and he brought me to faith in Jesus Christ, then I started to really dig in and find out what the Bible taught about government and everything else in our lives.
And of course, that really gives you a whole different perspective of what this battle is really all about.
That's right. And that's the foundation we need to get back to. And it's interesting when you get back to the period before the War for Independence, what some people call the Revolutionary War, it was the preachers. I have two volumes, probably 2,000 pages, of the political sermons of the founding era from about 1720 through 1805 or so. And it was really the preachers, the people of God, who studied what God had to say, and out of it came the Declaration of Independence and the Great Awakening period that brought the people to support that whole effort, and was really the foundation. And I sometimes try to tell Christians that who object to
hold that thought right there, please. Just... Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is John Stormer. His book is Betrayed by the Pinch, and John was simply talking about how you know, so many Christians are misled by what's going on. They really don't understand the religious foundation upon which our freedom rests, and they don't understand the Christian's responsibility for maintaining that freedom. So pick up the story there, John.
Well, as I sometimes try to challenge preachers and Christians who hold to some of that position, I believe ignorantly, they've put the emphasis, as we should, on reaching people for Christ and bringing them to see the truths of salvation and to have their faith in Jesus Christ. But then we need to see why he leaves us here to be salt and light. And I try to challenge some of those people that if these who have retreated from this whole area of life and compartmentalize their spiritual beliefs from any sort of relationship to the world, that if the preachers during the founding era back in the 1700s had believed what too many do today, we'd still be English.
would still be paying homage to the Queen. And it was really because there were a group of men. They were Christians, and they, of course, believed that we had a right to be free, and we're not answerable to the king, we were answerable to God. And that it was God who gave us our freedom, not government. And it was really on that foundation that the American Revolution took place, this idea that men had an inherent right to be free. And as long as you have a king, he's going to misuse his power. The only way, of course, not for men to be free, was to do away with the control of the king and establish a government whose power was limited by the chains of the Constitution. That was a term that Thomas Jefferson had used when he says, "In matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution." And I really feel our founding fathers believe that man is basically sinful, as I do. And certainly if you can't trust men, you know, to take care of their own affairs, how can you possibly trust other men to control the masses? What you have to do is limit the power of government and let people do the best that they can, and but of course hope that they will be guided by God. And men, of course, who are guided by God will do the right thing, and those who will not be ruled by God certainly will be ruled by tyrants.
Exactly. And that's where we've come. And we've been talking about the Declaration. We've been talking about the courts. There's a whole lot more in the book that our listeners should be conscious about. For example, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Now, it was written right after the war between the states, and it was written to ensure that the freed slaves would enjoy and be available to all the other rights of every citizen, which was right. And that was the limit of the 14th Amendment until about 1950, when Earl Warren became the Chief Justice of the United States, and the courts got together, and they decided that well, they found a whole lot of other rights, supposedly, that citizens had, and through their interpretations of the 14th Amendment, a series of Supreme Court decisions transferred the power of the states to Washington, the federal government. And through those decisions in the 1950s and the early 1960s, the federal government was given total control over the schools of America, over the criminal justice system of America, over voting and elections, and a whole lot of other areas of government.
But of course, this was all unconstitutional. This was simply the Supreme Court usurping the power of the states in total violation of the oath that these men had sworn to uphold the Constitution. They were suddenly changing the Constitution because they wanted to centralize all power in Washington, D.C. They did not want people to be free.
That's exactly right. And Thomas Jefferson, certainly, we have a whole lot about Jefferson in the book, raising these questions back in the 1810, 1820, up till 1825, when Jefferson died, he said again and again that the greatest danger in America would be a dictatorship by the courts, and that there were no limits put on the courts, and it was going to be the destruction of America as they knew it.
Well, of course, there really is Article 3, Section 2, that you can, you know, if the Congress had the courage, that they could limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. But, you know, here again, you know, this is simply a way, it's sort of like amending the Constitution to try to get away from the problem. The problem is we've got people in the Supreme Court who don't believe in America, who are violating their oaths, and Thomas Jefferson said it's very difficult to impeach them, but I believe they ought to be impeached, but it's never going to happen until the American people understand what these wicked people are doing and why they're doing it.
And you mentioned Article 3, Section 2, and until maybe the last 2 years, that was never discussed. And anyone who would bring up, for example, ever since prayer and Bible reading were in schools were banned by the courts, there has been a majority in both houses of Congress, doing over these last more than 40 years, who at least say that they're opposed, that they would like to amend the Constitution to override what the Supreme Court said. And a number of times it's been brought up, and it gets a majority vote to amend the Constitution, but it takes a two-thirds vote of Congress and then three-fourths vote of the states. So it's never gotten an amendment to do that, or to ban abortion has never been passed. But they don't need that two-thirds vote. As you indicated, in Article 3, Section 2 says, the Congress, by a majority vote, just a 50% vote of the House, 50% in the Senate, could say that the court has no jurisdiction over issues of abortion or public acknowledgement of God or some of those other things. And in the last 2 years, at least, a few people have been raising that and applying it. Now, and there's horror expressed. How in the world can we limit the courts? But they've done it all the time. Tom Daschle, for example, the senator from South Dakota, until recently, he inserted into the EPA laws that were passed a couple of years ago that the courts would have no authority to impose certain EPA regulations on South Dakota farmers who regularly burned off parts of their land to restore the land and so forth. And he simply put in there. So they use that Article 3, Section 2 provision regularly, but not on the key things that we would like to see and need to be done.
And of course, that was Tom Daschle was the actually he was the head of the majority leader in the Senate.
That's right.
When the Democrats were in power, and he was eventually they got rid of him when the Republicans came in a couple of years ago. But you know, it was the fact that Tom Daschle understood that it was very easy. He was afraid, of course, the environmentalists would block the farmers from burning their fields, so they just put that stipulation in that the Supreme Court couldn't intervene and override the law that they were passing.
The lower courts,
right,
could not intervene, and if the lower courts can't, an issue can't get to the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, now of course it can't, but that can't that be used against the Supreme Court as well?
Well, yes, it would certainly be used that way.
So I think it's so. There are many solutions, but nothing is going to happen until the people understand our Constitution, understand the Declaration of Independence, and the importance of the Declaration. You know, at one time, why they always used to, you know, 4th of July was our leading holiday. It was the birthday of America. And they used to get up and they used to read the Declaration. They used to talk about it.
That's right.
But they don't do that much anymore, do they, John?
No, they don't, because the Declaration has been so downgraded. An illustration that I like to use, because again, people got wakened up and say, that happened? 2 years ago, the Minnesota legislature, and it's basically been fairly liberal, but as a result of about 10 years of work by a number of people up in Minnesota that were concerned about education, they traveled back and forth across the state to anybody that they could get to listen about the dangers of America 2000, which was the older George Bush's education bill, and then Goals 2000, which was Clinton's, and then we now have No Child Left Behind.
And that's Ted Kennedy's, but George Bush got it through.
Yeah, right. Some good people in over a 10-year period went out into churches and went out any place they could get an audience, and started to awaken the people of Minnesota to what the federal government was imposing on the schools of Minnesota. They got involved, and they used some of my Nundare College education in the process. And as a result of all this effort, 2 years ago, the Minnesota legislature passed a bill saying that we will refuse to accept any more federal money for our schools, and along with it will reject all the federal controls on education. They had awakened to the fact that only 2% of the money that goes to, only 2% of the total school money in America comes from the federal government. After they had taken it first from us and spill some in Washington and send it back with a whole lot of controls. And so the legislature passed and said, we're not going to accept any more of that money, and we're not going to accept the controls that go with it. In the process, they decided then we're going to have to spell out the foundation or the basis for schools in Minnesota. And when they laid this out, they said in the preamble that all education in Minnesota shall be based on and promote the foundational precepts of the Declaration of Independence. And it went through the House, and it got to their Senate, and then to a conference committee. And when they came to a conference, that provision had disappeared concerning the Declaration of Independence. And I have a video of the conference committee where Senator Michelle Bachmann, a great lady, challenged the chairman of that committee, his name was Senator Steve Kelly, as to what happened to the Declaration of Independence and that provision that had been placed in the law. And Senator Kelly said, you have to understand, Senator Bachmann, that the Declaration of Independence has no basis in American law at all. Well,
that is the very foundation of American law.
That's right. And it's the result of, and in the book we look at, for example, Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard professor, big liberal.
Right, he thinks torture is perfectly all right, except as long as it's somebody else being tortured.
Right. But Dershowitz has written a recent book, America Declares Independence. And in it, he says very flatly that Thomas Jefferson and the 56 people who signed the Declaration didn't understand the meaning of the words they put in it. And so we no longer have to pay any attention to them.
I mean, it's men like Dershowitz who are really part of the problem, with an intense hatred of America. And if you've ever really read him or listened to him speak, he hates America. And when you understand that, it then all makes sense. He doesn't believe in individual freedom, although he professes to be a liberal. He wants this autocratic system with all power centralized in Washington and the destruction, the crushing of those of us who would wish to be free under God.
By the way, we ought to probably, that bill passed by the Minnesota legislature that said we're going to take no more government money and no more government controls. Washington got upset. The No Child Left Behind people, the George Bushes and the Kennedys, and the pressure was placed on the Minnesota legislature that this was an embarrassment to the president, and as a result, they went back and amended their bill and said that none of this will take effect until the Department of Education is abolished in Washington.
Well, I think the first thing we should have done is abolish it, but it should have been abolished a long time ago.
That's right.
Ronald Reagan promised to do away with the Department of Education and then absolutely refused to do it. So politicians, no matter Democrat or Republican, of course, they say one thing, they have a different agenda. And the great tragedy is the American people never remember what the politicians say, and they really don't understand what they do, and that's why we're in the mess we are today.
And so many of the politicians, they don't understand the foundation. The lawyers of America are not taught the Constitution and the Declaration. In fact, I think we mentioned in the book that I did a survey of over a year and a half period, 100 judges and attorneys that I met, and I asked them the question. I said, when you were in law school, you took a course in constitutional law. And most of them groan and say, yeah, the book was that thick. And then I'd pull my Constitution out of my pocket and say, when you took your course in constitutional law, did you actually read and study the Constitution itself in class? Or did you just study Supreme Court decisions which told you what to believe about it? And I got up well over 100, and I only found two attorneys who had actually studied the Constitution in constitutional law class. Now, some others said I did it on my own so I could bug the liberal professors. But as a result, there's an abysmal ignorance in America, even among everybody that goes into the military, everybody goes on a police force, everybody goes on a school board, everybody takes any office at all, swears to uphold the Constitution. Very few of them have ever read it.
In fact, I love the story you tell in your book about Judge Roy Moore, who, Ten Commandments judge, who, it was said they told you he never had studied the Constitution in law school. It was only a few years ago that he really got started really reading the Constitution and really understood what it said. And he said, what was it? I've been in trouble ever since.
I've been in trouble ever since.
We're going to be back in just a moment or two. Our guest this evening has been John Stormer. And his book is, let's get your website out.
It's LibertyBellPress.com.
LibertyBellPress.com. John's got a list of a lot of the things he carries. There are a lot of things we carry as well, but LibertyPress.com. And we'll be wrapping up the program here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, John, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program for us.
Well, I would challenge our readers, first of all, get betrayed by the bench. Dr. Stan has it. It's available from him, or as he mentioned, my website, which I'm not real happy with. It takes a genius to work your way through it until we can get it updated. But get this book, Betrayed by the Bench. And learn. It's the foundational document. Get it, read it yourself, then get one for your pastor, get one for your own attorney, and start this education job. This Thursday night, a lady here in St. Louis has brought together a group of 16 people, and they're gonna study through this book once a month, a chapter a month, to really try to educate people as to the foundations of America.
I love that one quotation you have in there. I haven't quite memorized it yet, but from John Quincy Adams, talking about the virtue that we find in the Constitution, you know, really was embedded in it as a result of these noble and ideas that come. Do you have that quotation right handy?
Well, I'm going to try and pull it up. I think it's on page 28 or 29.
Because you read that, I think that's really such an important statement. Well, John Quincy Adams, of course, was the son of John Adams, and certainly was an outstanding Christian. And he was elected, as I remember, in 1824, and just preceded Andrew Jackson there. Do you have the quotation?
The virtue which has been infused into the Constitution of the United States was no other than those abstract principles which had been first proclaimed in the Declaration of Independence, namely the self-evident truths of the natural and unalienable rights of man and the sovereignty of the people, always subordinate to the rule of right and wrong, and always responsible to the supreme ruler of the universe for the rightful exercise of that power.
That's one
this
of the most
was the platform upon which the Constitution of the United States has been erected.
That's one of the most profound statements you'll ever read, came from John Quincy Adams. It's something that I will one of these days get memorized. I think we have to understand that the very foundation of our Constitution rests on the Declaration of Independence. John Stormer, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
It's been great. Thank you.
Good night and God bless. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly John Stormer is one of my favorite guests. And I hope you've enjoyed it. His book is Betrayed by the Bench. If you'd like to know more about his book or so much of many of the other things that John has written, None Dare Call It Treason, None Dare Call It Treason 25 Years Later, None Dare Call It Education, and now Betrayed by the Bench, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go up on our webpage at www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And you'll be fascinated by to read this book. It will be an inspiration to understand the foundation of our freedom, and I hope that you'll be motivated to join us then in this epic struggle that is being carried out by those who hate God, who hate Christianity, who hate the God of the Bible, because, of course, you don't have to be a Christian to be a good American. But if you want to destroy the Judeo-Christian foundation of this country, why, you're not a good American. You have a different agenda. Because, you see, the ideas of our country were based upon the limitation of the power of government so men could be free. But there really are people who want to control us. There always have been, there always will be. America was different because these men had to violate our laws. Well, once they got their people in the Supreme Court, and they began changing our Supreme Court and violating the oath that they had sworn to uphold our Constitution, at that point, why we began to lose our freedom. And the fact that the ministers have not spoken out, and really if the conservative leaders, the anti-communist leaders, the Christian leaders of this country are not speaking out, this is why we're in the trouble where we are today. So you're going to have to help us. You're going to have to help us to get the information out and to reach others. It's really going to be up to you, and if not now, when? And if not you, who's going to do it? So if you value freedom, if you understand that the war in Iraq is a great diversion, so while our boys go overseas to supposedly fight for freedom in Iraq, we are losing our freedom here at home. It's exactly the way it was with Vietnam. Vietnam was designed to be a diversion, and if you doubt that, you want to get our latest newsletter. It's called Deja Vu in Iraq. Deja Vu in Iraq, and it'll be available in a few days, and it certainly gives you the background of what Iraq is really all about, and gives you the quotations from the man who was instrumental in getting us into Vietnam, who readily admits that the road forward and home in the 1960s was not by retreat in Vietnam. If you really believed in the great new departures in health and education and welfare, in rebuilding our cities, and the cause of truly equal opportunity, don't say we ought to get out of Vietnam. But exactly the opposite is the case. If we got out of Vietnam, there'd be a strong reaction to our domestic program. And if we get out of Iraq, there'll be a similar strong reaction to their program to destroy America and merge us into the one world government. Understand what this is about. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, Deja Vu in Iraq, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't been in touch with us before, we'd be glad to send you a free copy. It'll be available probably in the next 10 days up on our website at RadioLiberty.com. Understand what's going on in Iraq. Understand what's happening in America. And then join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation, or any nation under God, can long endure. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Dr. Garth Nicholson, and Dr. Nicholson was a professor at the MB Anderson Clinic for many years. He taught medical school for 25 years. He's certainly known internationally as a scientist. He has over 600 peer-reviewed articles, has served on the editorial board of a number of magazines, medical magazines, medical journals, and was the editor of several of them. I think he's given up some of those things, but he has the most amazing story to tell. He's put it into a fiction form, although it is really based upon the facts, the experiences that he has. Some of the characters there, the composite characters, I recognize them because our paths have crossed many times. But certainly the story that he tells is laid out in something called Project Daylily with one L. And it's a fascinating story. It reads like a Tom Clancy novel. The only trouble is it's really true. And certainly his life and his wife's life were endangered because they stumbled onto an experimental government genetic engineering program. But I'm going to let Dr. Garth Nicholson tell you the story. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me on your show again, Stan.
Why don't you pick up the story there where I left off, and I'll just let you run with the ball.
Well, as you were saying, we inadvertently stumbled across a major program that was a development program for biologic weapons in the United States, testing in the prison system and testing on military recruits and other military personnel, and who knows who else. And we got involved because, quite frankly, this happened after the Gulf War, and our stepdaughter served in the Gulf War and came back and became slowly ill with Gulf War syndrome, or what we call Gulf War illnesses. And they were trying to say she had post-traumatic stress disorder. We knew that wasn't true. She had a real medical problem. And in going about solving not only her problem, but those of her colleagues in the 101st Airborne Division and a lot of the special forces groups that they served with, we found that they had a very unusual infection that they brought back from the war. And in fact, some people who never even went to the war but received the multiple military vaccines came down with the same infection. And this infection is called a mycoplasma. Only the infection that they had, we know, was genetically modified. We found certain genes in that that we didn't expect. One of the genes was from the HIV-1 virus, the AIDS-causing virus. And when we took a look at the types of genes that we found in this microbe, we decided that it must have been weaponized. It must have been developed as an incapacitating biological warfare agent. And the very sad thing was that after we first made our discovery public, we were attacked viciously by everyone you could imagine. And the story gets worse because then we found that in the prison system they were testing this particular microbe because the prison guards were getting sick and their families were getting sick, and they were coming to us when they found out that we were taking care of soldiers and their families who became sick.
And, of course, we're talking about millions of Americans being incapacitated by genetically created diseases, chronic disabling diseases, spreading silently across America to the average individual. It really doesn't matter until someone they know gets ill or somebody they themselves get ill. Well, I've run into an awful lot of people with these chronic disabling illnesses, and unfortunately, medicine has very little to offer them. Well, Dr. Nicholson, pick up the story there. Certainly, when people come into the doctor's office with a story of chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or or the symptoms of Lyme disease, and we're talking about literally millions of Americans, and many of them, of course, will have associated progressive neurological disorders, ALS, MS, other neurological diseases, and the average doctor really has no idea. These things are not well described in the medical literature. They sort of go from doctor to doctor. They simply sort of become the rejects of society, and this is certainly what was happening to our veterans when they were coming back from the first Gulf War, isn't it?
Absolutely. There were greater than 150,000 that came down with a variety of different illnesses. But the worst cases had really undiagnosable illnesses. That is, they couldn't really diagnose what was wrong with these veterans. So they simply gave them Prozac and other antidepressants and sent them home. And, of course, many of them died. And the numbers that we have seen are in excess of 28,000. And, of course, that's not a number that anyone will ever see, because this came from actually inside. And this is one reason why we had to fictionalize our book. Really was to protect our sources inside.
And then what you're saying is that the people in government who know what's going on, who would come to you but could not afford to come out publicly for fear that they'd lose their jobs or pensions or maybe they'd even lose their lives.
That's correct. In fact, we had somebody at the VA Central Command who was giving us information, and I don't know what happened to him, but he suddenly disappeared, and we thought he may have gotten caught doing this, and we just don't know what happened to him, whether he was transferred to Alaska or somewhere else. We just don't know, and that's the scary part about all this, is that people disappear, and it's not, I would say it's not a common event, but it has happened, and we didn't want that to happen to us, so we decided some time ago, in fact, even the special forces groups that we were taking care of told us that we'd better have a public profile so that we wouldn't just disappear, and so we did. We took their advice, and we went to public, and went through. We had a number of TV broadcasts, and we were on the BBC and a number of other places that gave us some visibility, and I think this helped protect us to some degree.
Well, I'm sure it has, because as credible as it sounds, ladies and gentlemen, people do disappear in America today. People have unexplained suicides. I've had a number of my guests who have been very outspoken, who died under very mysterious circumstances. And as the story you're about to hear tonight unfolds, why you'll find out that a number of people associated with Dr. Nicholson died mysterious deaths.
That's true.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Dr. Nicholson and I were just talking about the people that he would come in contact who died mysterious deaths. Now, one of them was an Army colonel.
He was a retired Air Force colonel,
right.
And he was a physician, and he was actually in charge of patient care at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, and he was one of my bosses. And we had been discussing this very problem, and he knew quite a bit about it since he had been a career officer in the military and rose to a very high level. So he was actually very well informed, and he told me that the morning that he was murdered in his office that he was going to do something about it. And what happened was 15 minutes later, a perpetrator entered his office and shot him 6 times in the back of the head and walked out, dropped the weapon and walked right out and disappeared.
And of course, you never managed to find out who did the deed.
The crime was never solved, and it remains unsolved to this day. And some of my other colleagues died under very mysterious circumstances, and it just got to be terribly threatening. And so we left to Houston, came out to California, and we couldn't go to a normal academic environment because they just poisoned the well so much that we were. Couldn't do that any longer, even though I was a full professor at the University of California before I ever went to Texas. And so I couldn't go back to a position there. So we had to form a nonprofit research institute, a small one, to continue our work to help people. And there are millions and millions of people out there that have chronic illnesses, and to keep secret these programs, they have no idea of what's wrong with them, and they can't get any help whatsoever from public health organizations or physicians, for the most part, are very poorly trained to handle, as you mentioned, these chronic illnesses, and this is one stumbling block that we run up against. And I know this is a major problem because, as you know, you and I both taught in medical school for many, many years, and this is a subject that is not covered very well, very adequately in medical training. That is the problem with the chronic multi-symptom illnesses. It's just not handled very well, and our HMOs avoid it, so you can't, if you're in an HMO, you can't expect any help whatsoever. I got into a major fight with a couple of HMOs that were denying care for people that were in their HMOs just because they couldn't properly diagnose these illnesses. Well, that's no reason to deny care. And these ended up actually in courtroom situations both times, but they settled out of court. And why did they do that? Because it was opening up Pandora's box. Because there's so many people sick with unusual autoimmune diseases, these fatiguing illnesses, and other types of illnesses that have very little, that is, the pharmaceutical companies have very little to help these people.
Well, let's get to the story of Huntsville, Texas. Huntsville, Texas has several, I think, what, three prisons there. And could you give the story how you got involved with Huntsville and really what was happening there as far as an epidemic of Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis and multiple sclerosis? And of course, nobody ever considers these diseases are epidemic, and yet they were in Huntsville. So could you tell our listeners that story?
Well, this is a small town of about 30,000 in East Texas, and the main employer is the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And they run three prisons in the area, and so a lot of the people are employed at the prisons. And they were having an unbelievable outbreak of these chronic illnesses, autoimmune and fatiguing illnesses, so much so that these unusual illnesses like Lou Gehrig's disease were, there were 70, 75 cases alone in this tiny little town when the incidence should be about 1 in 100,000. So something was very, very wrong. And we were contacted by not only the physicians in the area, but the prison guards and their family members, because they were getting sick and their families were getting sick. And they were showing some of the same signs and symptoms that we had publicized that the Gulf War veterans were suffering from, to show that they didn't have psychological problems like post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, these people knew they didn't have post-traumatic stress disorder, but they didn't have any idea what was going wrong. And what was going wrong eventually was found out. And actually, the families themselves were the ones that dug up the information, actually dug up the documents to show that they were conducting experiments in the prison system before the Gulf War. And we now know pretty conclusively that they were testing things like mycoplasmas and modified mycoplasmas in the prison system before the Gulf War, and that a lot of these people died from it, and they were being taken to an army base outside of San Antonio for autopsy. And then they were being secretly cremated. And one of my pathology fellows happened to stumble across this indirectly, because he was in charge of the autopsy service that by law was supposed to get these prisoners that died for autopsy, only they weren't showing up there. And I asked him about it, and he looked into it, and he mysteriously died a couple years after that. So it became a very difficult situation to continue our work under those circumstances, with people dropping like flies around us. And so we decided that we'd better move to another location, which we did.
Well, now, of course, you mentioned that the normal incidence of Lou Gehrig's disease is about 1 in 100,000. And here in this small town of 30,000 people, they had, what, about 30 cases?
Well, they had about, I believe, about 70 cases.
About 70 cases.
And they were, even on one block, that one of the guards was living on one block, there were four people on one block that had Lou Gehrig's disease, and that's absolutely unheard of. And these were not genetically linked to Lou Gehrig's disease. The only linkage, in fact, was the prison system, because we were able to find out, and actually the families themselves got together and formed a support group, and they found out that all the people that were sick were connected one way or another to the prison system. And the first people who got sick were the people that actually work in the prison system, and that was followed by their family members who got sick, and so on and so forth. Exactly what we found with the Gulf War veterans. The veterans who came back sick and had chronic infections passed them to immediate family members, and they became sick with similar signs and symptoms. There's an interesting story about this, and it also fits in with the Huntsville story, and that's the children, when they got these infections, didn't come down with the same constellation of signs and symptoms. They had some unusual neurologic signs and symptoms, so they were often diagnosed with autism or attention deficit disorder, or what we call autistic spectrum disorders. And so that was something that was a little unusual that we weren't expecting. But now we've done a study in California, in Central California in particular, with the counties where there's a very high incidence of autism, and we find similar infections, not exactly the same that we found in the prison system and in the veterans, but certainly they had similar types of infections like mycoplasma infections and chlamydia infections and so on in this group of children. So here's an illness which is autism of children, which is basically of unknown etiology. There is some linkage to, we feel, to the multiple vaccines that they received, and the same thing with the veterans of the Gulf War. There's a linkage there to the multiple military vaccines that they received. Epidemiologists have made that link very, I think, conclusively. In two different studies, one in the United Kingdom and one here in the United States, in Kansas, linked the multiple vaccines to veterans' illnesses. So we feel that we've opened up a door, and this door may lead us into a completely new direction of a variety of these chronic illnesses which have unknown etiologies.
Well, I think it was fascinating reading your analysis of these children with autism. Did the majority of the children that you studied with autism have mycoplasma and other chronic infections?
About 60% of them have, for example, mycoplasmal infections of the group that we studied. We don't know how this is going to translate all across the United States. These may have been in areas where there was a very, very high incidence, and the reason being because these infections were passing in the population. So that could be one of the reasons why the incidence was so high in this particular county. So we don't know if the incidence is going to be that high across the United States.
But, well, now the question that arises is, are there mycoplasmin in the vaccines? Has anybody checked to see?
Well, here's the interesting question, because I just happened to take an airplane trip one time when I was going back to Washington, and there happened to be a person who worked for a vaccine company next to me. We got to talking about the vaccines, and I kept asking him, why don't they test for these types of infections? Because we've implicated them in somehow connected with the vaccines. And he sort of looked at me and said, you want to drive us out of business? You know, he said, we can't do that. We get such a small margin on each lot of vaccine that we make that if we have to do all this extra testing, we just can't make a profit on it. I said, well, that's ridiculous because, you know, what do you mean make a profit? People are getting these vaccines, and you don't know whether there might be a contaminant of this type in them. No, we only test for rapidly growing bacteria, and he explained the types of tests that they did, and they wouldn't detect these types of infections if they were present in very low level in the vaccines. Some of the vaccines, like the anthrax vaccine that's used in the military, are stored long-term at refrigerator temperatures, and You know, if you put anything in your refrigerator long-term, what happens? Well, it gets contaminated fairly quickly. So it's extremely difficult to store anything long-term at the refrigerator temperatures without it showing some kind of contamination.
Well, I think really the tragedy is that autism is simply exploding in our young people. But certainly today it's estimated that 1 in 6 American children has either a neurodevelopmental and or a behavioral abnormality. About 1 in 166 children has autism. And the fact that 60% of them have these chronic mycoplasma infections, and certainly are some of these children related in any way to the Gulf War?
Well, yes, that's how we first got onto this. As a matter of fact, we were studying the families, and the children that we knew were infected because we tested them were showing these signs and symptoms of autistic spectrum disorders. And that's how we got started going in that direction.
Well, the implications of this are indeed frightening. And here are these men going overseas to fight for freedom. They come home, they're ill. In fact, it's interesting that 30% of the people coming home from the current Iraqi war within 3 months have come down. And the government insists it's post-traumatic stress syndrome, but they're ill, they're incapacitated. 30% of them, ladies and gentlemen. The boys who go overseas to fight for freedom and come home and many of them will never be the same again. Those who are not crippled, those who do not die, they picked up some sort of an illness. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. We were simply talking about the boys are coming home from the current Gulf War. Now, we don't know, but we do know that the government admits that 30% of them are ill. They call it post-traumatic stress, but that's what they call the Gulf War illness that incapacitated so many of the 695,000 American boys who went to the Gulf for the first Gulf War. So, do we have any idea what sort of illness the boys who are coming home now have, or will we have to wait years to find out?
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to wait, because the initial stance of the Army and Navy Medical Corps is that they have post-traumatic stress disorder. From what I've seen, that is the veterans that have contacted us from the current conflict, I don't think that that's going to be the case. I think it's going to be more like the first Gulf War. It may not be the same numbers, because they've learned not to give all those military vaccines between 1 and 3 days. That's very immunosuppressive, and I think it just set up a lot of people for these chronic illnesses. And also, they had a number of other exposures as well, environmental exposures that weren't replicated during the current conflict, such as burning oil fires and things like that. But nonetheless, they did receive essentially the same military vaccines as before. And some of these vaccines are just not good vaccines. The anthrax vaccine in particular, we've written and published reviews on this particular vaccine. And in particular, we were asked by the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, Dr. Merrill Nass and myself, to prepare a review on this. And we did. And they gave it a lot of publicity when it was published. But the military didn't do much about it, because they bought into this anthrax vaccine, and it's a very, we think, a very poor vaccine for use to protect our troops against biological warfare and aerosolized, weaponized anthrax spores.
But does it have complications, in addition to the fact it's not very effective?
Well, it's not as effective as it should be, and unfortunately, the complications are quite horrendous. And many of the people that I've talked to that have had the vaccine became ill from the vaccine, and some recovered and some did not. Some are still ill. And we just have to find out more about what went wrong. But we know that one of the things that went wrong was that it set them up for chronic illnesses, and whether they were minor contaminants in the vaccine or whether they picked up opportunistic infections because they were immunosuppressed, we just don't know at this point in time. But it's a very scary situation. And I think it's continuing to be a scary situation, and history is repeating itself all over again. And we really have to think these things out a little bit better, and why people receive these vaccines. They should have a very good reason for receiving them. And I know the U.S. Postal Service employees have refused the anthrax vaccine. They don't want anything to do with it. Once they found out how dangerous it was, they decided not to do it. And even the ones that took the vaccine, some of those are now sick. So it's a scary situation, and we sure could have done a lot better. Some of this, by the way, is covered in our book, Project Daylily, where it explains to people what went wrong, and at least some of what went wrong. We don't know the whole story, of course, but this is a major part of the story. And we explain it. We tell people what they can do about it and so on. So it's actually, in addition to being a medical mystery and our personal story about what happened, it does help people understand what went wrong and how to correct it. And we've, along the way, developed a number of approaches to treating these types of mycoplasmal infections.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, please. I'll be right. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're just talking about the tragic victims of the first Gulf War, and now many of the young men are coming home from the second Gulf War. About a third of them are ill. The government will admit that, but they call it post-traumatic stress. They say it takes 2 or 3 months, and then they come down with the post-traumatic stress. Well, most of the people I know who come home, they got it. If they've really got a psychological problem, it doesn't take 3 months before they develop it. But with this, whatever it is, it does seem to take a certain length of time. Now, certainly, there's been a definite correlation between the marked or significant increase in the incidence of anterior lateral sclerosis so-called Lou Gehrig's disease and the Gulf War illness. Hasn't the Veterans Administration actually acknowledged that there's a significant increase in the incidence of ALS in Gulf War I veterans?
Yes, they have. They have finally acknowledged that. We raised a stink about that, and they just couldn't avoid it because these people were dying, and it's pretty hard to cover that up. So there is a much higher than expected incidence of MS and ALS in the Gulf War I veterans, and it's too soon to tell about the Gulf War II veterans, but I have a feeling that it may not be as explosive, the incidence rate, but it's going to be above normal or above expected for the age group that went over there, and this is very troubling. We have to do something about this. We have to do much better than we're doing.
Well, now, didn't a lot of this relate back to the Operation Paperclip, to the Nazi scientists who were brought to the United States following the Second World War to continue their macabre experiments they were using in Hitler's Germany?
Well, we think there is a link. And, in fact, the microbe that we found in the Gulf War veterans, primarily Mycoplasma fermentans, a specific species of mycoplasma, was one that was being developed by the Ifarben company during World War II, and it was being developed as a cofactor in to kill people, actually, as one of a mixture of organisms as a cocktail to kill people. And we probably, although we can't prove it, but it's likely that it was brought back in Operation Paperclip with the Nazi scientists who were rounded up by the army after the war, and brought back and put in laboratories in the United States to continue their work. And they did that. They continued their work, we feel, and developed essentially all these new ways of causing disease. And once you develop something, you want to test it, and that's what we think happened in the prison system. We can only hypothesize that that's what happened, but the records that were dug up by these prison families indicate that the prison boards approved these types of tests on prisoners in the state system in Texas and probably elsewhere from what we've heard. And many of them got sick and died and passed their illnesses. Now they're being passed into the population, the general population, through the family members. And they will continue to penetrate further and further into our population unless we recognize them and do something about it.
Well, of course, the difficulty is that the word is not getting out. But there's these new diseases that we never saw before. We never saw the chronic fatigue syndrome. I mean, certainly when I went to medical school, never described. I practiced medicine for 20 years. I went to practice in 1960. Really wasn't until, I guess it was the latter part of the 1970s, wasn't it, or early 1980s, when the first cases of chronic fatigue showed up?
Well, a few cases have been around for longer than that, but they were small numbers, and all of a sudden the incidence was just going off the map. And now there's kind of an explosive incidence of these types of chronic illnesses, along with autoimmune illnesses of sometimes of undescribed or undocumented nature and so on. And we've seen quite an increase in things like rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis and a number of other things. And of course, rheumatoid arthritis we've linked to mycoplasmal infections, and we've published that, and other people have as well. And so there are a lot of the chronic illnesses that are linked to these chronic infections, and that's what our book goes into, actually. And again, it's Project Daylily, and there's actually a website for it. It's www.projectdaylily.com, and Project Daylily is spelled as one word. And people can find out about the book, and they can find out where our website is for the Institute for Molecular Medicine. And it's www.immed.org. Just think of immediate.org.
And of course, when you spell Project Daylily, there's only one L in Lily rather than two. So Project Daylily. And of course, why did you pick that name? Didn't that have some very, very significance?
It does. That was one of the projects designed actually to eliminate people.
And of course, you were actually told this by people on the inside who are afraid to have their names put out there?
That's correct.
And you could understand why nobody would want necessarily to come forward themselves. They might tell Dr. Garth Nicholson in private. But you see, we're dealing with crimes that dwarf many of those for which men were tried at the Nuremberg. And some of these people, obviously, at the key echelons of our government. We can't let the American people know the truth, can we? Hail, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're talking about his new book, Project Daylily. It's fascinating reading. As I've said before, it's like reading Tom Clancy, only trouble, this is true. And certainly there were a number of threats, a number of efforts to take to kill both Dr. Nicholson and his wife. Episodes described there, and actually it wasn't just one, wasn't it several occasions when both your life and your wife's life were in danger?
Yes, that's exactly true, and we managed to dodge those bullets, more or less. For the most part, they were poisonings, in which my wife actually came very close to death in one of these poisonings, and I was incapacitated for a while in another instance. And this is, you know, mentioned in the book. You know, that we've tried to dramatize this a little bit, just to show people what it's all about. But the important thing is that not that we were the victims of this whole thing, but the important thing is that this information needs to get out. People need to know about this to protect themselves and their family members, and also their loved ones if they're in the military or even if they're in prison. They need to protect themselves and the people that they love, and the only way to do that is to get the information that they need to protect themselves.
Well, it's so difficult for people to really believe that anything could be that evil, that people would create new diseases to kill large numbers of people. And yet, of course, we know that they've been working on biological diseases for a long period of time. In fact, Lyme disease, an entirely new disease, didn't exist, at least. I'd never heard of it until I came back from Africa in 77. And sometime in the late 1970s, or I guess it was about that time, suddenly this new disease occurs. Would you like to tell our listeners just a little bit about Lyme disease?
Well, Lyme disease, which appeared in Old Lyme, Connecticut, which is kind of a bird's flight away from Plum Island, the U.S. Department of Agricultural facility where tick-borne diseases was being investigated, and actually they were running tests and everything and along with the Army. The interesting thing about Lyme disease, it's a collection of different infections. It's not just one infection. The primary infection seems to be the Borrelia spirochete, which is an unusual type of bacteria that has kind of a corkscrew shape in certain phases, and that gets inside your cells. But the overwhelming majority of those same patients also have mycoplasmas, and the most prominent one that we found is Mycoplasma fermentans, the very same species that we found in the prison guards and the veterans and so on. So this is a very dangerous disease that has this combination of different infections. And then
hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson, the formerly professor at MD Anderson Clinic, internationally known scientist. We're talking about his book, Project Daylily. And we were talking about Lyme disease, a relatively new disease. You know, I'd been entered medical practice in 1960. I went off to practice in Africa for a couple of years, came back, and it was in the late 1970s or early 1980s when this new disease called Lyme disease first appeared in Old Lyme, Connecticut, very, very close to a place called Plum Island, just across the inlet from Plum Island, where the government had been experimenting on some sort of biological diseases. It was a secret government laboratory over there on Plum Island. There's a book called Lab 257. That was the number of this government laboratory when they were doing the secret research. But Dr. Nicholson was talking about, really, this is not simply one disease. It was really a series of diseases, wasn't it?
Well, it's a series of infections. They try and call Lyme disease one disease, but it's a very complex illness. And in fact, there are probably a number of different actual diseases associated with the Lyme's complex. And depending upon the different types of infections, and there are at least four different infections that we've found, and others have found too in Lyme patients, and you can get different combinations of these infections. And of course, the Lyme Borrelia, the spirochete is the most common, and then the mycoplasma, and then there's another type of rickettsial infection, Ehrlichia, and then there's a protozoan infection as well that can go along with it. And other bacteria and so on. So it's a very complex illness, and its treatment is very complex because of all these different infectious agents. And the very sad thing is that there are very few physicians who dare to go into this area and treat patients for Lyme disease, because they're scrutinized by the medical boards, they're scrutinized by the government, and so on, you know, for giving too many different antibiotics or treating them in certain ways, and so the spotlight is on them. So most physicians just try and avoid this area, and so unfortunately it leaves most patients high and dry. They can't get any help for their insurance companies or their HMOs, and there are very few private practice physicians which dare to take Lyme disease cases. But thank God there are a few ethical physicians out there that will take the Lyme disease patients, and they're trying to very hard to keep up with all these different infections that they have.
Incidentally, for our listeners, we do have a four-tape set on Lyme disease, and we actually interview several of the doctors who do treat this and have a certain amount of expertise in it. However, I don't know whether they're acquainted with all the things that Dr. Nicholson is talking about, because it's far more than simply the Borrelia spirochete. It's these other diseases that go along with that. So we're talking about a complex with four diseases. Would anybody design diseases like this to infect people? Well, you can read Zygmunt Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages. It was published in 1970 on page 57. In the footnote at the bottom, he quotes somebody else saying that, you know, in the future, and he's talking about by 2018, we'll be able to create storms, and we'll be able to create droughts, and we'll be able to create chronic diseases to disable large numbers of people, but very few people need to know about that. What a terrible thing to say, that people would actually not, you know, say this is a terrible thing to do. And yet it didn't seem to bother Zygmunt Brzezinski, one of the most powerful men in the world today. So anybody who'd like to have that page out of his book would be glad to send it to you. I think it's important for people to know that back in 1970 they were planning on and creating chronic diseases to use against the enemy. And I'm not sure who the enemy really is. Maybe it's the American people. Under any circumstances, certainly there must be, what, 800,000 to a million people with Lyme disease out there?
Well, I think it's much higher than that. It's because many of the people really have a difficult time getting a proper diagnosis. And these infections hide deep inside the tissues and inside our cells and cause their havoc there, so it's very hard to actually find them in a blood sample, for example. And so that's one of the problems in diagnosing and treating these illnesses, is getting an appropriate diagnosis.
Well, of course, even to find a laboratory that can do it. And if they go to your website, that's immed.org, like immediate, like immed.org, you will actually tell them where they actually can get testing, won't you?
Yes, we give some instructions on the types of tests that we suggest that they should have run, and some options on where to get testing done. Laboratories that are reputable, and we don't have any financial or link in any way with these labs. We just know that they're competent. I've been to these laboratories, and I know that they do their work competently. But there are very few labs, as it turns out, that can do these complex, what they're called high complex testing.
Now, do you use PCR testing, or what do you do?
Well, mainly they use PCR, which is a genetic test which finds the genes of the microorganisms, for example, and identifies the certain elements or parts of the gene, so they know absolutely that that's the infection that's there. And there are other types of immunologic tests as well, and in some cases it's best to run the whole gamut of tests to find out. But it's rare that a physician will know about this or to know what test to run, and it's even rarer if you're in an HMO or some other provider that they'll allow you to even have those types of tests done.
And this is a great tragedy, if we've changed the whole structure of our medical care. And instead of having what at one time was the greatest medical care in the world, now, of course, are the financial restraints and the massive increase in the cost of medical care is beginning to restrict people's ability to get the treatment for these diseases. And I fear that many of these diseases are actually produced in laboratories and being used experimentally just to see what will happen. Certainly. Have you had any suggestion that a treatment might, at least in some cases, reverse the disastrous effects of either multiple sclerosis or anterior lateral sclerosis?
Well, certainly at the early stages of the disease, we've had, you know, in the past a lot of success in treating these patients. In fact, we got into a lot of trouble down in Texas because the neurologist raised quite a stink that we were taking their patients away from them, which was ridiculous. I mean, what we were doing was, instead of just following the patients until they die, we were actually giving them treatment options and so on. But it really threatened some of the neurologists down there. And that's part of the problem, is that the classically trained neurologists really don't know how to effectively treat any of these diseases. And so they just tend to think that they're not treatable, that they're fatal diseases, and that there are no options available. But in fact, there are. But if you wait too long, in general, there's just too much cell death. There's too much neuronal death in the central nervous system. You can't reverse that once it happens. But if you get it early enough, you can. And we've showed that.
Well, I think for our listeners out there, the book Operation Daylily is, of course, Project Daylily is an adventure story, but there's also a lot of a history there of medicine and of course, what Dr. Nicholson has learned, not only on his own, but what he's been told by people working within the very secret organizations who were afraid themselves to come forward, but confided in him about some of these macabre experiments that have gone on. And now they've been unleashed on the American people, and literally millions of people are ill out there. Well, you know, Chris, your book actually has an endorsement from a Nobel laureate, doesn't it? And a certain number of key scientists have actually given their name in support of your book?
Yes, that's true. And in fact, he's a Nobel laureate. He's one of the discoverers of the hormone-releasing substances, which are a very, very brilliant discovery. And so he knows a lot about the neurochemistry of brain disorders and so on. So I naturally thought of him, that he'd be very interested in the book, and he was quite interested in the book. And also we have some other people, including a retired Army colonel that was involved in biologic defense during the first Gulf War. And his last statement was, and his review of the book was, this is a story, this is a true story that needs to be told to the American people. And I think it does, and that's why I'm urging people to get the book and read it.
Well, I think it's a fascinating read. We actually had a very good response from our listeners. Somebody bought, I think, four or five of them the other day. So, and we've had reordered several times. So, and of course, the book is available, Project Daylily. And if you'd like to know more about it, our telephone number 1-800-544-8927. Now, you know, certainly, have you come under any pressure at all since you wrote the book? Because you've exposed really some things that there are people in government that do not want this information out.
Well, and there are also some people that want it out. And that's the interesting thing that we found. We work a lot with people, of course, in the armed forces. And there are a lot of people in the armed forces that want the story told and want it to come out because they don't want these things to continue. They want them to stop. Generally, these are line officers that are involved in combat units and so on, and particularly special forces units. My wife and I, in fact, are honorary colonels in the U.S. Army Special Forces, and we're the only two honorary Navy SEALs in the history of the Navy. And there's a reason for that, and the reason that we help those units when nobody else would, when they had chronic illnesses that they were trying to say were post-traumatic stress disorder, but that's pretty hard to tell a Navy SEAL that they're not psychologically fit when they go through probably the most difficult training in the world to become a Navy SEAL. So we help them, we help their families and so on. And they want the story told, and they want the public to know about it. They want these programs stopped, and they want better medical care. And I don't blame them for any of that. And so hopefully people will read the book, and eventually there'll be enough pressure to change these programs to remove, root out these bad elements, and make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Well, I think what's so devastating is the realization that so many men are ill, permanently ill after the first Gulf War. I think that the government will admit probably well over 150,000.
That's right. That's the figures, and actually that's the number that actually registered with the VA. And there's probably a lot more than that. They didn't even bother to register because they thought it was a waste of time, which in many cases it is. But still, it gives us something to go on in terms of official numbers. Interestingly enough, the same thing happened to the British forces. and the Australians and the Canadians, and so they're fighting the same problems in Canada and Britain and Australia and other places as well. And all these countries that have these problems from the first Gulf War all took the multiple military vaccines, of course, the exception was France. The French forces that were deployed during the first Gulf War did not use the multiple vaccines. They had a different strategy. They used prophylactic antibiotics and protective gear, and they did not have the same problem with Gulf War illness. They had a few cases, but only a very minor number of cases. And so this is a very interesting thing that happened. Forces that didn't have the military vaccines that were made by the Western countries did not have the problem.
And I think that this is the last thing that they want the American people to question is the importance of vaccines. We're told, oh my goodness, it's done wonderful things, and yes, doing away with polio has been an amazing accomplishment, and doing away with smallpox has been an amazing accomplishment, but at what cost? And that is, of course, the thing that nobody ever wants to ask. And of course, when we see well over at least 150,000 veterans of the first Gulf War, and there are about 300,000 people that are still waiting to have their claims adjudicated with the Veterans Administration, that's an awful lot of people waiting to try to get something of the VA. And the reason that they don't have more signed up is because it takes such a long time to get through the Veterans Administration process, and they fight you every step of the way.
It's a difficult process to go through, and I hear the complaints of veterans almost on a daily basis that the VA is not taking care of their problems and not even addressing their problems and trying to give them antidepressants and other psychotropic drugs without really trying to get to the bottom of their illnesses. And again, this is a kind of a very universal problem that we have in our society right now, that a lot of people have these chronic signs and symptoms, but they're not getting effective care for them.
Would you like to just briefly touch on your lipid replacement therapy and some of the other things that people can do in the way of, perhaps trying to build up their immune system?
Well, we've tried to develop a number of ways that people could actually buy things over-the-counter, nutraceuticals, natural products, and so on, to try and boost their immune system, to try and take care of the damage that's been done, and lipid replacement therapy is one area that we've worked in, because we've known for some time that mitochondrial function, the little batteries inside our cells, are damaged when these infections enter the cells, are damaged from environmental insults and so on. And most people in our country now are not running their mitochondria, not running to 100%. So we've devised a way to help that repair process. And it mainly occurs when the membranes around the mitochondria are damaged and the mitochondria become leaky. It's kind of like a battery in your flashlight. If you strip the insulation off the battery, the charge in the battery will leak out and the battery will be no good anymore. And that's what's happening inside our cells. And it happens actually naturally during aging. And we've been able to reverse this process slowly by adding a food supplement to people's daily regimen. And that food supplement completely natural lipids that make up the membrane, and then slowly they replace the damaged lipids in the membrane. And so this is a product made by a company in New York that we've worked with, and other companies are starting to manufacture things like this now, but it's called lipid replacement therapy, and people can find out more on our website about it, or they can send me an email, and I'd be glad to send a brief review of the technique.
And so basically this is to try to overcome this damage that's done to the cell, the mitochondrial function. And with the proper lipids, are some of the patients improving?
Yes, they are. For example, we saw a decrease in fatigue of about 40 to 45% in people that have these infections, and also in a group of chronic fatigue syndrome patients. And so it's very effective. We did another study on just, these are normal age subjects of 70 to 90 something years old, and they benefited tremendously from having the supplement. So it's also an anti-aging supplement as well. So there are a lot of new things out there that people I think can take themselves to help solve their problems, their health problems.
Well, that sounds like something that might be good for me. I'm 76 now, so.
Well, it is good for you. My father, who's 94 now, going on 94 this year, takes these products, and he had an occurrence a few years ago. He actually got a mycoplasmal infection that almost killed him because it got in his heart, one of the things we didn't talk about were all the coronary cases that are caused by these chronic infections. Well, his heart became inflamed. His valve was essentially destroyed by these infections, and they replaced his valve, but his heart still wasn't functioning properly until I finally shook the heck out of the cardiologist to get them to treat properly his mycoplasmal infection.
And, of course, don't a lot of these mycoplasma infections go along with chlamydia infections and can actually precipitate a coronary artery disease?
Oh, yes, they do. And chlamydia and mycoplasma are probably a major source of heart disease and vascular disease in general.
And, of course, this is, see, one thing we really don't talk about, I mean, it's all cholesterol to get the cholesterol down. But half of the people with coronary artery disease have an elevated C-reactive protein, which is a sign that there's inflammation. Would that be a correct statement?
That's correct.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hate to keep interrupting, but unfortunately we're governed by the clock here, so we have to take the breaks at the regularly specified times. So anyway, you were just saying that many of the patients really with coronary artery disease, or a significant number of them, do have these chronic infections that will respond to proper therapy?
Yes, they will. I mean, I gave the example of my father, who about 10 years ago had a major infection with a mycoplasma, and it almost killed him, and his cardiologists really knew nothing about these types of infections, so I had to educate them, and we got him properly treated, and he recovered, but he had no energy after that, and we found his mitochondrial function was way down, and so we started him on these lipid replacement therapy supplements, and now he's doing extremely well. In fact, he looks 15 years younger than his age, and people comment on it all the time, how much energy he has for his age. And I think a lot of it is due to the fact that we've repaired his mitochondria, the little batteries inside his cells.
And these are just a normal nutraceutical products?
Yes, they are. And these are things that people can buy on the Internet. They can buy, in some cases, at health food stores if they're sophisticated enough. And they go under names like Healthy Aging, for example, Propex, and names like that. But the active ingredient in these products is a substance called NT-factor, which are basically the natural lipids that make up the mitochondrial membranes and other membranes of the cell. And we replace those through a natural dietetic process, which is a slow process. It doesn't happen overnight. It's usually within 30 to 60 days people really get tremendous benefit.
Well, I think that's fascinating, and that's something that certainly I'd never heard of other than through you. Has this been around for a long period of time?
No, it hasn't. This is relatively new, and we're trying to push this because it's a very, I think, inexpensive way for people to recover their health if they're chronically ill, because people that have these infections, for example, that we've been discussing, almost all these people have loss of mitochondrial function.
And so, people with the decrease in mitochondrial function have any problem as far as their brain function is concerned, or do they have any bowel symptoms?
Well, both, actually. And the problem with the brain is that the brain is the most metabolically active tissue in our bodies, and it uses a tremendous amount of energy. And because of that, there are a lot of mitochondria in the brain. And when those mitochondria are damaged, then the brain function goes down. And we see this in a number of different ways. Short-term memory loss and brain fog and cognitive problems and so on in the brain. So we know that this is a problem, and it can be corrected if these infections, which often underlie the problem.
Well, that's off right there for just a moment. We'll be right back. Well, Dr. Nicholson is telling us that many of the people then who actually get the treatment with these lipid products really do improve dramatically.
Oh, absolutely. In our clinical trials that we've run, there's usually 35% to 45% decrease in fatigue alone. And of course, the other problems are often corrected to the same degree as well. So that's a pretty whopping change, particularly in terms of 30 to 60 days on just these products, these dietary products.
Well, I think there's so much more we could even talk about, but we're going to have to let you go because we're just about out of time. Our guest has been Dr. Garth Nicholson. His book, Project day later. You want to get it, you want to read it. God bless you. Thanks so very much for being with us.
Well, thanks, and I hope people buy the book for Christmas.
I hope they do, too. Bye-bye. Good night. All right, fine. That was Dr. Garth Nicholson, the book again. If you'd like to, Project Daylily, if you'd like to know more about that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, remember a book we just talked the first hour, Betrayed by the Bench, John Stormer's excellent book. I think all of this information is so vitally important that our listeners get and understand, certainly as far as Dr. Nicholson's story, that there really have been a conscious effort to create new diseases and to experiment with them to see what effect they would have. And these diseases now have spread into our general community. And more people are getting sick. Don't wait until it happens to you. Help us to get the truth out. I know one of my friends was a oncologist, a doctor who treated cancer, wonderful Christian gentleman, and he got some blood transfusions in the process of having a surgery, and of course he's come down with chronic fatigue. His whole life has changed. And when you get these diseases, why, your life changes forever. These are new diseases, and they've been inflicted on the American people. Could this have happened by accident? Well, those of you who have not seen our video, Plan Population Reduction, need to get it. Or you can certainly go to my website and pull down our Population Control Agenda monograph. That's www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can get our Population Control Agenda monograph. And then, certainly, remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, if you'd like to get a copy of one of our newsletters, if you'd like to understand what's really going on over in Iraq, and how Iraq is really just a gigantic a diversion from to keep the attention of the American people from understanding what's going on here at home, we simply use the statement by the man who involved us in Vietnam, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a member of the Bilderberg, a member of the Skull and Bones Secret Society, and he lays it out very openly in an article in Foreign Affairs magazine in January of 67. We'll be glad to send you a copy of our newsletter, Iraq, Deja Vu in Iraq. That's Deja Vu in Iraq. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like a free copy of that, or it'll be available up on our website in about 2 weeks. That's RadioLiberty.com. Hope you'll go there. Hope you'll listen to our programs on the Internet and tell others about our programs. If you're listening on the Here's Help Radio Network, remember we do a program there at 12:30 every Saturday on the program you're on the station you're listening to now. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. But pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.